He's the author of a number of books, including The Rocket That Fell to Earth, Sweetness, the most recent Football for a Buck, and his brand new one, which is terrific, Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Laker Dynasty. Jeff Perlman, the book is so good. Last time you were on, by the way, I have to mention, when you were on talking about Football for a Buck, your analysis of Donald Trump remains, I think, the most spot-on analysis anybody has done of him.
I wish I had a bigger voice back then. I really do. I swear to God, I really wanted people to listen. And I mean, how many times I have to say during that he ruined the USFL, that he was a con man, that he lied about it all. I said it over and over again, but I'm only one person and one small sports book author. So here we are.
Yeah, yeah, well, exactly. All right, now you've written about the Lakers before in your wonderful book, Showtime. What was different, if you could pick one thing that differentiated the Showtime teams from these teams of the late 90s and early 2000s, what would it be?
Oh, boy. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a guy like Kobe as far as... Like, Magic Johnson came, he was young, he was out of Michigan State, but, man, he was all about winning and team first. And I'm not saying Kobe wasn't all about winning. He certainly became that way. But when he arrived, it was a lot of ego, and it was a lot of youthful bravado, and it was a lot of trying to find a voice when you're only 18 years old and you don't know what that even means. And the friction from the beginning was Shaq, and Shaq nicknamed him Snowboat from the start. I mean, there's just... Kobe was a different sort of bird. You know, you could say Shaq had a lot of magic in him, the persona and the, you know, the just a larger-than-life sort of sense of giving and joy. But Kobe, there's nobody on those Lakers, those earlier Lakers, like Kobe in any way, shape, or form. It's just different.
And as you point out, too, in your foreword to the book, this book is of a specific time in Kobe Bryant's life, and it was a different Kobe than he would eventually become.
Not very. I mean, the Kobe who tragically died, you know, he was father of four, and he was a businessman and a coach and an Academy Award winner, and this really well put together guy. And Kobe, who was sort of during this era, could be really aloof and never really got to know his teammates and viewed everyone as a rival and just wanted to rip your head off. And he's just a different altogether person from young Kobe, kind of complicated Kobe. Who is this guy and what is he trying to be and why does he act this way, to the Kobe who we saw, you know, bragging about his daughters. So it's really sad. I mean, the whole, that doesn't feel like he's gone, but it sucks.
The seeds for this Laker dynasty were sown even before Kobe's arrival. I found a particularly interesting part of the story to be the return of Magic Johnson. And, man, what a dysfunctional unit that was, with Nick Van Exel and Cedric Ceballos, who seems to be maybe one of the worst teammates a person could ever have.
He's not a top 10 best. I mean, it'd be funny if you showed up where you work and you're like, hey, everyone, I have a new nickname for myself. I want you to call me Chice after franchise because I'm the franchise around here. Like, try that at the dentist office or your, you know, whatever, wherever you work. You get laughed off, but he nicknamed himself Chice. And you remember, I wonder if it's just me. Like, when Magic came back in that 95-96 season, it was huge. Like, don't you remember it as kind of huge?
Oh, yeah, because we didn't know what it was about. We were still trying to figure out what it meant to have someone be HIV positive, and we didn't really have a complete understanding of how you got to that point where you could play again. And, yeah, it was the biggest story in sport when he came back.
And it almost feels like it never happened, but he comes back, and, you know, Kareem isn't there, and Worthy isn't there, Byron's gone, all these guys are gone, and he's basically stuck with Nick Van Exel, Eddie Jones, and Chice, and it just doesn't work. Like, it's just, he's like, what the hell is going on here? It's like a person now my age, I'm 48, whining about millennials. Like, he was basically early into whining about millennials, and the comeback was kind of a flop, and everyone was sick of each other. And Magic retires, and that's when Jerry West really freaking ramps it up and works his magic, and somehow he's able to get Shaq and Kobe when there was no reason to really think he'd be able to get either of them at the same time.
And you talk about this a lot. Kobe's such an interesting guy. Young Kobe was so determined, so focused, but also a bit of an outsider, too. And as you point out, a lot of that comes from spending so many of his formative years in Italy. And even at Lower Merion High School, he didn't always fit in with his peers terribly well.
No, he was a different kind of guy. And you can look at his background, and maybe it's Freudian a little bit, but he basically, you know, was a kid who was brought up in Italy with a famous dad, and he was, you know, a black kid and not a black world at all. He moves, you know, as a young teenager back to the suburbs of Philly, you know, very leafy and wealthy area. And again, one of the few African-American faces, and his dad is famous and he's this great basketball player. Goes to the senior prom with Brandy, who was a huge star at the time. And he's just this, like, he's this not fully developed person. You know, most of us, we go through high school and we have that moment where we get our driver's license, and learning to drive, we hit a pole and we ask a girl out or we ask a boy out and they say no, and we're embarrassed, and we have toilet paper stuck to our shoe and we don't see it there. And, you know, we get an F in class and it's all hot. Go through those things because you need to go through those things. Like, you have to go through those things. He didn't go through a lot of those things. He was young and protected and gifted. And when he arrived in the NBA, he arrived like someone who'd always been young and protected and gifted, and he was awkward. So it was a real life adjustment for him that took a long time.
Is it too much to say that he played John Calipari going into the draft that year?
He and his people did. He and Jerry West. I mean, basically, the Nets had the number 8 pick, and they were going to take Kobe Bryant. And the GM of the Nets was John Nash, who just loved Kobe Bryant, and the workouts were amazing. John Calipari was the new coach of the Nets, and the Nets did something interesting. They gave Calipari final personnel say. So John Nash was a GM, but a GM with only so much power. And basically, Kobe already has an Adidas deal. He decides, and his people decide, you'd be much better served in L.A. than in East Rutherford, New Jersey. So first Kobe calls the Nets, and he says, you know, I really don't want to be near my parents, so I'd appreciate if you, I don't want you to draft me. And Kobe's agent calls the Lakers. They're all calling Calipari. And they're like, you draft Kobe, he's going to Italy for the year. He won't play for you guys. Then Terry Kittle's agent, David Falk, calls Calipari and says, if you don't draft Terry Kittle's, who really wants to play with you, I will never have a guy play for you again. Calipari is young and dumb and new and freaking out. The other one is first, say, big news being rejected by a high school kid. So John Nash is begging him, we got to see Kobe. This is all just bluffing. Obviously, he's going to play for us. And right before the draft, they're settled on Kobe Bryant. Calipari makes an announcement. He goes, listen, here's the deal. We have the 8th pick. If Kerry Kittles is there, we're taking Kerry Kittles. If not, we're going with Kobe. And, of course, Kerry Kittles is there at the 8th pick. Nets get him. Even Kerry Kittles told me when I interviewed him, I would have drafted Kobe, too. And then Jerry West is doing a gig because his deal lined up with the Charlotte Hornets. And he gets a lot of feedback and he gets Kobe Bryant. It was a brilliant mastermind bit of basketball maneuvering.
Knowing what we know about the current Secretary of Education, I took great delight in reading how horribly Rich DeVos screwed up negotiations with Shaq in Orlando.
Because he was a small thinker in a big world. This is the Amway guy. And he, number one, he thought everyone should be loyal. He's supposed to be a loyal employee. Number two, there's definitely a little bit of racism there. Like, look, I'm paying these black guys all this money. They could at least show a little, you know, fealty. And he just didn't think these guys were worth it. You know, the organization's raking in the dollars, but he doesn't think Shaquille O'Neal is worth the money. So he lowballs him with the opening offer. And the Lakers come in. And they start shedding salaries. They trade two guys to Vancouver just to get rid of the money on the books. And the Lakers come in, and Jerry West is savvy. And Shaq's agent has always wanted him to go to L.A. He's tired of it being a big fish in a small pond. Then the Orlando Sentinel, the newspaper of record, does a poll asking, is Shaquille O'Neal worth $120 million? And the phrasing of that poll is important because nobody's worth $120 million. You know, like, in and of itself, nobody is worth that kind of money. In the basketball world, where DeJuan Howard just got $119 million for the Washington Bullets, yeah, he's worth $120 million. So that poll, which skewed really negative towards Shaq, really pissed Shaq off and wounded him. So when Jerry West anties up with $120 million and the Magic come in late and they're sort of after dragging their feet, they're like, oh, no, we can offer you that too. Basically, Shaq was like, forget it, I'm out of here. And he left for L.A.
We're talking with Jeff Perlman here on Downtown. His new book is Three Ring Circus. How important in making this finally all come together, how important was Rick Fox to the mix?
I love that question. I thought you were going to say Phil Jackson. Rick Fox is great. Rick Fox is a guy who tried his best to understand Kobe. A lot of guys were repelled by Kobe, and at times Rick was, but he really tried his best. They both spoke Italian. They both had international backgrounds. Fox only came to the Lakers. He was supposed to stay with Boston, and he was kind of he wasn't a star with Boston, but he was their best player on some really bad teams. And when Rick Pitino was hired, the first thing that Pitino told him is, we're going to build around you. And then at the last minute, he pulled the offer so they could sign Travis Knight instead of Rick Fox. So Fox had really nowhere to go, and he signed with the Lakers for a minimal amount of money. And Jess was invaluable as a leader, as an orchestrator, as a triangle offense, as a disciplined player. But the Lakers did really well this era. There were a lot of Rick Foxes, Robert Orange, Derek Fisher, and Derek Harper, and John Sally, and J.R. Reed, and Ron Harper, and Horace Grant, and they just brought in a lot of smart, savvy role players, maybe a year or two past their prime, Brian Shaw types, but who were going to be able to help weather the storm of this weird in the two superstars.
One of my favorite characters in the book, because, well, much like the players, you can't help but like him, even if he was driving them crazy with his talking, was Coach Del Harris.
Oh, I love Del Harris. I went to see him in Dallas. He was a coach really before Phil. Nick Rambis is an interim coach. You know, Del Harris was just a guy from Middle America, very conservative and button-up shirt, and he looked 70 when he was 30, and he knew basketball like nobody's business. Like, there's no reason to think Phil Jackson had any better basketball knowledge than Del Harris. In fact, he probably didn't. But Del Harris had one fatal flaw. It was he just talked and talked and talked too much. And maybe that worked back in the day. Maybe when he was with Milwaukee, you know, Sidney Moncrief is willing to listen. Shaq and Kobe in that era, they were not. They just weren't. And he went on and on and on and on and on. The players started to tune them out. Vic Van Exel could not stand playing for him. And ultimately what happened is, the players made it clear that it wasn't working, and that kind of led to Phil Jackson. But I love Del Harris. I really do.
You did a wonderful job of chronicling what Phil Jackson learned first from Red Holtzman and then beating the bushes in the CBA. I actually interviewed Phil when his Albany Patroons were here playing, I think it was Billy Ray Bates and the Maine Lumberjacks back in the CBA
days. Nice.
But that was a great learning experience for him in a fairly low-pressure situation.
First, I want to say two things. Number one, the fact that you were able to drop a Billy Ray Bates name reference into this interview means you should get paid triple this year. I'm going to fight for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no charge. And I only take 10% as your agent. And I think his time, I talked a lot when I was with Phil Jackson about Albany and the CBA. And I love that time period. Like, he was driving the team bus because there was the most leg room.
Right.
And at one point, he had to renegotiate his contract to get more to his per diem, and he ended up getting $3 more per day for his per diem when he was a coach of the Albany Patroons. It's just this awesome, quaint little time period. And if you remember the names that came through that league, there are a lot of like Todd Murphys and Tony Campbells and Michael Ray Richardson's, like good NBA players who just sort of needed a shot or a second or a third chance. And that's really where Phil Jackson, I think, learned a lot about how to deal with players and how to navigate the world of professional basketball as a coach, not as a player.
Kobe and the Triangle, though, were not exactly a match made in basketball heaven in those early days.
No, it wasn't really made to be. You know, when Phil started coaching the Bulls after Doug Collins was fired, he told Michael Jordan, he was basically like, look, man, you can average 34 for the rest of your career, and we can be an 8 seed. Or you can try this system that gets more people involved, average 28, and we might be winning championships. That was the appeal of Phil Jackson when he arrived in L.A., that he had these 6 rings as a coach. And they did it with Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. And I think Kobe wanted it to work, and I guess it did work, and it went 3 titles. But Kobe was just an eternal... There was always a guy trying to play the triangle and also trying to shoot 25 times at the same time. And those are not things that go together very well. And he used to drive teammates crazy because he just... he shot a lot, and he broke down the triangle a lot, and he had to be talked to a lot. And he was gifted. There's no doubt he was a gifted basketball player, and it's understandable that he felt, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. But it was very hard to be his teammate at times.
The Shaq-Kobe dynamic is obviously the centerpiece of the story, and it's fascinating. But I was also really interested in the whole relationship between Jerry West, as you describe him, a guy with literally no ego, up against Phil Jackson. He didn't want Phil Jackson there, and that relationship was fraught from the get-go.
I mean, if you think about it, it's hard for not that many examples of guys, people with that level of success brought together mid to late career. It's actually really, really unique if you think about it. Like, there have been, you know, like Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry were on the same coaching staff as assistants. Bill Parcells had Bill Belichick working for him. You know, there are examples of great on the same team. It's very rare that you have two legends joined together well into their careers and who are very set in their ways. And Jerry West was kind of this neurotic, on all the time, hard driving, lives his job without fail, you know, maniac in a great way. He's the best personnel guy in the history of the NBA. And Phil Jackson is this, you know, highly intellectual, kind of aloof, kind of awkward, kind of arrogant. They're both kind of awkward, actually. You know, like, guy with six rings. And Wes wanted to stick with Kurt Rambis, who'd been the interim coach. Jerry Bussett very much wanted to Phil Jackson. It was really awkward and really uncomfortable. There was this one moment when Jerry West walks into the locker room when he thought he could after a game, and Phil Jackson's still talking to the players, and he's screaming at Jerry West to get out. It's probably the most embarrassing Jerry West ever was as a professional, that moment. And I actually think a lot of ways that led to the beginning of the end, with Jerry West, not in a malicious way, but he just kind of realized, like, this team wasn't his team anymore. This organization wasn't his organization anymore. And he probably needed to move on.
You spent some pretty good time out in Montana with Phil Jackson. Did he suggest a book for you to read?
I don't think he did, actually. That's so funny. We did talk about books, but I don't think he suggested a book for me to read. If I would have read it, if he did, though.
He loved
Motorcycle Diaries, and I actually bought that book. And I hate to say this because I have a book coming out. I couldn't really get through it. It wasn't my favorite book.
When it all fell apart, there's so many stories about how it all broke down. I think my favorite one, if you don't mind relating it from the book, is the story of the phone call Kobe got from his new teammate, Caron Butler.
Oh, boy. So, you know, they make the trade, and Caron Butler is one of the three players, along with Lamar Odom and Brian Grant, to get from Miami for Shaq. And Caron Butler calls, hey, Kobe, you know, I'm Caron Butler, I'm new on your team, blah, 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 great, blah, blah, blah. Okay, all right, yeah, man, good, good, good. Hang up. Next day, Kobe changes his phone number. And, I mean, if you think, like, none of his teammates were invited to his wedding. Very few had even known he was dating. Like, very few had ever been to his house, including Derek Fisher, who was probably his closest teammate friend. He was just a different kind of guy. I remember during the Colorado whole sexual assault situation, he was asked, when he reported back to camp in Hawaii, he was asked, will you confide in your teammates about this? And his response was, why would I? Like, he just wasn't, I'm not saying that was good or bad. That wasn't him. He was not that guy.
And as you point out in the last chapter of the book, in terms of that Jessica Matheson case, there remains to this day no doubt from the law enforcement people of what went on.
Correct. I don't, the guys I interviewed on, and it's, you know, it was a lot easier to write about when Kobe Bryant was alive.
Right.
Definitely more awkward. But, yeah, I mean, they were convinced that they had Kobe Bryant. And basically, you know, the case was about to go in pretrial. And the woman involved, who really, in her defense, had gone through hell, not just, you know, possibly being raped, but the National Enquirer stalking her, different people stalking her, threats, blah, blah, blah. She basically settled out of court in the civil, in the civil realm, and the case went away. But they're convinced that Kobe Bryant was going to prison. And I'm not, I think they're probably correct. I think he would have too. There's a lot of stuff there.
In the pantheon of great NBA teams through the years, Jeff, where do you put this this three-peat Lakers team?
You know, it's funny. I don't know. It's a tough one because I don't think we think about them that much. It's sort of weird considering it wasn't that long ago. We talk a lot about Golden State. We talk a lot about LeBron. We go back to Magic. We certainly go back to Jordan. We go back to Bird. For some reason, I feel like, and maybe it's because Kobe Bryant's career was really divided into two acts. This one and then the second act when he comes back with Paul Gasol and Lamar Odom. I feel like people don't think of this team with the all-time greats. The fact is they won back-to-back-to-back titles. They had the most dominant big man of his era and the best guard of his era in the same court at the same time, playing for the best coach of all time. So I do think they're one of your top five best dynasties that's ever existed.
The book is called Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. Jeff Perlman, this is, as it always is with your books, an absolutely wonderful read. We had a blast talking with you once again, and a memorable introduction that will go down in our Hall of Fame for many years to come, I'm sure.
I believe you've inspired my next book. It is called Shaquille O'Neal, The Effing Music Years.
That is a must read as well. Jeff, we wish you much success with the book. Can people still get autographed book plates from you if they reach out?
Of course. Just hit me up on Twitter at Jeff Perlman, or you can email me at ngold22@gmail.com. If you show me that you bought the book, I'll happily send you book plates and a bunch of the Lakers stickers.
Excellent. Get the book. You will love it. Jeff, thank you so much. Good to talk with you again.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Jeff Perlman with us here on Downtown.